464 Liberty or 464-8295. So if you have something you'd like to talk about, doesn't have to be what I'm talking about at all, why you just give us a call. Well, as we look at what's going on today, why the Federal Reserve Board lowered the interest rates another quarter of a point, taking the interest rate, and that is, of course, the discount rate, the rate at which banks can borrow from the Federal Reserve, down to 2%. So people can actually borrow money from the Federal Reserve. Banks can borrow money from the Federal Reserve at 2%. They can lend it to you at 5 or 6%, and that's a nice little markup, isn't it? But, of course, what the Federal Reserve is doing is exactly the wrong thing. The Federal Reserve has two choices today. They can either lower the interest rates and, of course, make credit increasingly available, which is just like printing more money, and flood our country with money and credit. And right now they're doing that at about the rate of 17 to 18% a year, which will be reflected in the inflation rate at the end of this year. They can either do what they're doing and destroy the value of the dollar by inflation, or they could do what they should be doing, and that is raising interest rates, limiting the availability of credit. Yes, it would be much harder on Wall Street, but at least it would save the value of the dollar. Now, of course, when you destroy the value of our currency, you destroy the value of the savings of every individual who's worked their whole life putting their money away and hoping one day they're going to be able to retire comfortably, and it will destroy the money in insurance policies and annuities and in pensions. It'll destroy the value of money in CDs, in money market funds. Anything that's linked to the dollar is going to be destroyed by what they're doing, and they're doing exactly the wrong thing, because this is not going to solve the problem. You see, what they've done is they've created an impossible situation. If they continue doing what they're doing, lowering interest rates, why, they destroy the dollar. If they raise the interest rates, they destroy the economy. But you're going to sooner or later have to raise interest rates if there's going to be any value left to our currency. Otherwise, we'll end up like Rhodesia or Zimbabwe is today, like it was during the Weimar Republic, as it was in Russia in the early 1990s, when American experts went over there to help them straighten out their economy and produce an inflationary spiral that destroyed the life savings of those unfortunate people who'd spent their whole lives living in a communist regime. We've seen the same thing happen in South America time and time again, as certainly the middle class was wiped out, and those people who understood certainly could survive. Those people who put their money into something of inherent value, and it maintained its value, but that would have to be something like land. Well, right now, of course, land is not a good thing to buy. In fact, there isn't very much. Certainly housing is not a good thing to buy. 650,000 homes in the United States went into foreclosure in the first quarter of this year. That's 650,000 homes. In Nevada today, about one in every 54 homes is in foreclosure. In California, about one in every 74 homes is in foreclosure. Now, of course, we've got a lot bigger state, so we got a lot more homes in foreclosure. But that's an awful lot of people are losing their homes, an awful lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people have already lost their homes. 650,000 homes are currently in foreclosure, at least the first quarter of this year. And somewhere between 8 and 10 million Americans will lose their homes before this is all over. And we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. We'd love to know what you think about what's going on, but certainly as we look and see what's happening, we find a General Motors losing $3.5 billion in the first quarter of this year. That's $3.5 billion in the first quarter of this year. General Motors Financial Corporation lost at least $500 million. And what you're seeing all across the country is more and more groups of people are simply defaulting on their loans. People with credit cards are defaulting on their loans. And let's see who we have on the line. Hi, who do we have calling? Who do we have calling?
Oh, this is Donna.
Oh, well, good to have you with us. Where are you calling from?
I'm from Michigan.
All right, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do have a question. I have been...
You're going to have to speak up real... go ahead.
Oh, certainly. I've been wondering if you could give me some light on the decade of the 20s and relating to what's happening today.
Well, it's like deja vu all over again. And, of course, this is Donna calling from Flint, Michigan. And basically, of course, what happened in the 20s, which established the Federal Reserve System in 1913, and they did that so they could finance the coming war, America's involvement. But by the early part of the 1920s, while the Federal Reserve System began, of course, printing more and more money and made credit available and had interest rates low, and what this did was created the Roaring Twenties. I mean, things were really great up until 1929, when the Federal Reserve System began to contract credit and began to contract money. And then, of course, we began moving into the Great Depression. And every time the economy began to right itself, the Federal Reserve would contract the availability of money again. We had plenty of money to send over to Adolf Hitler. We had plenty of money to send over to Stalin, but there was no money here in the United States to get our economy moving. And of course, we are just entering that same period. We are already in a recession. It's only a matter of time before we're in a major depression. And of course, so many people are going to lose their homes, their businesses, their savings, because at least in those days we had a stable currency. We no longer have a stable currency, and we're in real trouble as a nation. Not only that, but we've lost our moral compass. We have no leaders, and the media is controlled. The average individual doesn't understand that before this is over, most people are going to lose everything they have financially. How does that answer your question, Donna?
I mean, you may not...
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. We have Donna calling from Flint, Michigan, and our telephone number here, if you'd like to give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Donna was asking what the relationship was between what happened in the 1920s and what's happening today, and I simply said it's deja vu all over again. Only in the 1920s we had a stable currency, a gold-backed currency, and we had people of moral integrity, at least in some places in government, that no longer exists today. We no longer have a stable currency. We no longer have a gold-backed currency. And, of course, the people in power are doing everything wrong. And, of course, eventually this will destroy the economy. This nation impoverishes our people. But it's all about really destroying the economy, destroying the middle class, impoverishing our people, and moving into the world government. There is a timetable, Donna, and they're working on this timetable, and I believe this is the time that they've been planning for. So it's going to be a difficult time ahead. Anything else you'd like to say?
Thank you for helping us figure out what's going on.
Well, all we can do is let you know what's going on, and believe me, and I'm not a prophet at all, but I've done a lot of studying. I've lived a long time. I lived during the Depression. I was born in 1929, and I can remember the people coming to the door and begging for food. And my mother would always give them food, and they'd put a little mark next to the doorbell. So the next fellow came along knew that this is a home where they would feed you. And we shared what we had with others, and I hope during the difficult times that lie ahead, we'll all be doing that and helping others. Anything else, Donna, before we let you go?
No, thank you so much.
God bless you, and thank you so very much. And please encourage people back there in Flint to listen to our programs, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment, this is Open Line Wednesday, and we'd love to hear what you're thinking about. But as we're looking at what's happening in the economy, and of course you're being told that the inflation rate is, well, maybe it's 4%, but don't agree. The one, of course, it comes to, the inflation part that they're going to pay the people on retirement, on Social Security, the inflation, as far as the Treasury bill, we have index-based inflation, proof Treasury bonds, and so... But they're only going to pay 2% because the government says the inflation is only 2%. They're simply lying. The inflation rate today is about 12%. look and see what's happening to the price of gasoline. Look and see what's happening to the price of food and the staples that you need. And even many of the things we were importing are going up in price. And I know I buy them because I'm sort of an odd size. I'm 6'5" and 230 pounds, and I need fairly large clothes, so I buy them from a place called Blair. And it's interesting. It's been interesting over the last several years just seeing how those prices at Blair keep going up. And, of course, they're importing things from Thailand and from South America. Good products. We like them. They're economical. But the prices are going up, and they're going up on a regular basis. And we're going to see more and more in the way of higher prices as the value of our dollar drops. And what most people don't understand is one of the major reasons for the skyrocketing price of oil is the skyrocketing drop in the value of our currency. That and the fact that the price of oil is being manipulated. How do we know it's being manipulated? Why, very, very simply, because we've talked to wildcatters, people in the oil business, who said, look, you give us a floor of $25 a barrel for oil, we'll put all the oil you could possibly want on back, you know. But if we do not have a floor for the price of oil at $25, they'll do to us what they've done in the past, and that is that the big oil companies will simply drop the price. I mean, we're in full production at $25 a barrel, and they'll drop the price to $10. They'll wipe us out, and of course, a conspiracy in restraint of trade is a conspiracy, but since the oil companies own the presidency and own most of our politicians, nothing will be done to them. And so the wildcatters are not going to even consider developing the massive oil potential we have here in the United States, unless they have a floor so they cannot drop it below that level. Well, again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and let's go to Steve, who's calling from Illinois. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Dr. Stan. Always doing great when I can get your program. I was wondering if you saw where our great Vice President Cheney's going to have a lavish outfit made for him, built, you know, for it, so he can stay in Abu Dhabi.
No, I really hadn't heard about that.
But Oh yeah. It was on either. I forget. I won't quote the show, but it was on a television network, and of course it gets small press. And would you happen to know offhand what Abu Dhabi's really known for? How they've got their wealth?
Well, they're certainly oil and natural gas.
Well, that and mostly to a great degree. They are launderers. They wash money.
Oh, okay.
They take huge, vast amounts of money from all over the world, no questions asked, and it's made all into, you know, usable currency once again. And they do a lot of that. So can't people see that the Bush administration is going to be, and with Cheney moving there, that is a fact. I don't know for how long or whatever. But that money is going to be all from these Fortune 500 countries will be sent, who knows what front countries, companies they'll be using or whatever, but there'll be layers. But boy, that money is just going to come right back to them. This job well done for big business, and they'll get their payoff.
Well, of course, we know that when Vice President Cheney first took office for several years, he was getting something called a delayed payment, a delayed salary from Halliburton. Now, I don't quite understand how you can be working as vice president and get this delayed salary paid by Halliburton there, but some people might even think it was a bribe. And, of course, certainly we know, I believe that Halliburton has now moved to Dubai over there in the Persian Gulf. So if they are to be persecuted and prosecuted for war crimes and war profiteering, why, we won't be able to touch them. I had not heard that Dick Cheney was going to build a place over there, but I wouldn't be at all surprised. They probably have no extradition for the crimes he's responsible for. And what I'm talking about is getting us into this war illegally. All the people have died over there needlessly, and then, of course, the torture, which he's authorized.
Why, sure. And, you know, one that they did it to a great degree, but they're not so much anymore. But once in a while they slip up, and they use Donald Trump as their one of their big, big capitalists and everything, you know. But Donald Trump has said in no less than two times, I've heard once on Larry King, trailed off saying, why, they lied. He said you cannot trust this government. They lied to get us into Iraq. And that was, not much would be followed up with that. And, doctor, if I may say real quick, I think this country really started going downhill when we allowed Sunday, people can't go for one day without going shopping, whatever. And I frequent the stores and businesses that do close down on Sunday. And I think that was a downfall. And when cable came in, when I first got cable, I had it three different places. I had a successful business, two homes. And, no commercials, no this, no that, and we allowed them to go ahead and make us pay for it, plus the commercials, which are real lucrative. And when we didn't really rise up to that, I think they started, a long plan was put into place that, hey, this is the land of the sheep, we just take our time and bide our time in that, and Reagan started shutting down all those things that they tried to do in the 30s and that, and those laws were all put in, and Glass-Steagall and all them, and they trust laws and stuff, so, man, that fix really started taking hold for this fellow 1980 onward.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. I think television was probably the worst thing that ever happened because this is a means of controlling people's minds. Certainly, as you listen to radio, at least you've got to think. With television, you become almost hypnotized watching it.
And, oh, my God.
And I saw this in South Africa. We were living in South Africa in the mid-1970s, and it was really certainly they were working out their problems with apartheid. They would have done away with it. They were in the process of doing everything they could to move away from it as rapid as they could. But then television came in, and suddenly that whole society was changed. It used to be you went over to people's homes and you talked in the evening.
Sure.
Now you go over to people's homes and they're transfixed by the television and by the latest sitcom and, of course, the vulgarity from American sitcoms, the undermining, of course, of the value, the Christian values of that country, and today, of course, the country's in chaos.
My doctor, even in your children's programs, your most innocent, there's such overt, at least suggestive sexual gratuitous. There's no reason for that. I mean, there's been such a downgrading of TV and kids running with tattoos that, and you know, your body is your temple. You're not supposed to disfigure one's temple. And all these things that's going on, I just hate seeing it. And when you recall TV and being home, things like that, I know where you're coming from. And I sure wish we could get a piece of that and get these 535 people out and put the common person in again for which it was originally intended.
Well, hold just a moment. I want to get our telephone number out. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And you can tell the way Steve is talking how deeply he feels about what's going on, but what is really happening is an intentional effort to corrupt our society, to change our values. And, of course, because the media is controlled by five mega corporations, all of which tie into what I refer to as the Brotherhood of Darkness, for a reference on that, Professor Bendakian's book, The New Media Monopoly. But understand, they're intentionally trying to destroy us, to destroy our moral values. That's why the Rockefeller Foundation financed the Kinsey Report to destroy the social mores of our society, and that's why we have so many illegitimate pregnancies. They've destroyed the family. They've destroyed sexual morality. Hey, Steve, hang on. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Go right ahead, Steve.
Yes, and doctor, as I've told you in the past, and I'm sure you don't marry me from, but I am a Jew for Jesus, and I will die with that that passion and that, and that's what I really believe. And Christians, a lot of times, it's not because of my Jewishness, that a lot of times Christians will want to take Judas to task, but we should love Judas. If one would figure out, I mean, and go the one step further, the big picture, that God, Jesus, set this up as a play for the people of the world for salvation and that. And so he was just a necessary evil, if you will, but to be loved because Jesus brought him to make this all come forth. So actually, if you really play it out to its real end, that's what people would find out. And I love when you say, I can only envision. I have a lot of relatives in California, by the way, and I lived there many a year ago. And but when you talk about overlooking beautiful Monterey Bay, I can almost picture it, although I don't think I've really seen it. I was around the southern part of California, Orange County and Santa Ana, Westminster and all that. And, but it makes me, kind of puts my mind there in some place you would be living. And I'm going to let you go now, Doctor, and, you're the one thing that I really look forward to listening to, and, God bless you. I just am really happy that I'm able to get you in like this.
Well, God bless you. How are you listening? Internet or shortwave?
I'm on shortwave.
Okay. And is it coming in pretty well?
It does, yes. And I can get it in two. I wrote you a couple times an email and told you that somebody's trying to mess the signal up and that, you know, and some other little things going on. But you really fight the good fight. And, no, I get it in real clear, as a matter of fact. I like it now.
All right. God bless and thanks so very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
That was Bob. Steve Thank calling you. From Illinois. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, somebody had called and asked for a comment on what the politicians are going to be telling the American people in the fall, and of course they're going to be telling us that what we need to do is let the government make more jobs. That's the important thing. Government's got to make more jobs. Government's got to give everybody more money. After all, we're going to be getting our checks very, very soon, and of course, you know, government's going to give they're talking about probably $600, $300 to $600 checks. I haven't quite figured out which one they're going to get. I'm not going to get a check back, but most people are. Because nobody ever asks, well, where's the government getting the money that they're giving to the American people? Well, the government's getting the money that they're giving to the American people from the American people. Well, then why don't they just cut taxes so we'd have more money? Oh, no. We have to have the government giving you back at least a small part of what they're taking from you by force. And that's how we're going to solve the problem. What we're going to do, of course, is give everybody money so they can go down to Walmart so they can buy products that are made in China and, of course, stimulate China's economy. That's what it's all about. And it's not going to help our economy by pouring money out, by, of course, taking money out of one pocket and putting it in the other. It's still the American people's money. Remember one thing. Government has no money. Other than what it takes from us by force, other than what it can borrow from other countries, and believe me, we're just about borrowed out. We've got the biggest national debt that any country has ever had throughout all time, and then, of course, what they can make by just printing money and creating inflation. Government has no money, and when it gives you money, remember, it's your money, or they're destroying the value of your money. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you'd like to join us this evening, you have a question or comment, you can talk on any subject you want to. And right now we have Jane calling from Sacramento. Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Oh, good. Good. Oh, are we on?
You are on the air. You're being heard all across the world.
Well, you know, I know that the original date for the real ID was supposed to be coming up in a matter of, 11 days. And I know they're talking about pushing it back and they...
Well, you see, basically, of course, what they really want to do is get everybody with a real ID card, and they can put all of our names on there, and they can put an RFID chip, so you can be walking down the street, and they'll be able to tell who you are if they have a reader on that. But yeah, but basically, they got opposition. They really didn't think that any of the states would stand up to them. Now, most of the states knuckled under, but a number of them, like Montana and some of the others, did not knuckle under. And, of course, you have to understand, there are only a few conspirators out there. There are not very many of these people tied into the Brotherhood of Darkness. And when they saw opposition from the governors, from the American people, and people were angry with them, they backed off. So at least in those states that had the courage to take a stand, they put this off for some time. When it's going to be forced on us, I don't know. But remember, Freedom never close thy eyes in slumber, for thy enemies never sleep. And the enemies of freedom never do sleep, and they'll be back again. They want everybody with an ID card. They want all of the weapons. They want dossiers on every citizen. They want a system of informants, all in the name of fighting that wicked Osama bin Laden, who's hiding in a cave over there in Pakistan, trying to take away our freedom. Incidentally, Moses Bhutto, who was assassinated in Afghanistan, you can go up on the internet and put down Bhutto, a video of Osama bin Laden, and she, very shortly before she was killed, said Osama bin Laden's been dead for a long time. She told that to Gordon Frost.
I remember that.
And of course, she's immediately killed, and we forget it. And of course, the information I have is that bin Laden's been dead for a long time, but we have to have an enemy to fear, and boy, he sure looks like an enemy, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, the latest I heard is that they've given a grant for the states to chase, so that's how they're probably going to try and rope in the rest of the resistors.
I know. I think for our listeners, they have to understand that this is going to be very expensive for the states, and so one of the objections to it was, well, the federal government's telling us to do it. We don't have the money, and so we're not going to do it. Well, that was the wrong argument. We should have said the concept is wrong, the idea is wrong, it's un-American, and that's the reason we don't want to do it, rather than, well, if we had the money, it would be all right. So I think that they've argued themselves into a very, very poor position. I think that some of the people have done that intentionally, because I think that many of our so-called leaders are really all in favor of this totally regulated, dictatorial, fascist society that the invisible government wants, or the Brotherhood of Darkness wants.
Right. Well, my friend, I had a friend who went to the Real ID site, and there was this question and answer article, and you never read so much doublespeak. It was like it just wanted to make you projectile vomit or something, you know.
Well, of course, they're going to try to confuse you, because they really feel that we're pretty stupid. They really have very little respect for the American people and their intelligence. I just hope that, of course, we're a lot smarter than they think we are. Remember that these are an elite, a ruling elite, who believe that it is their obligation to rule us common folks.
Well, I just wonder what the next event will be to sort of push this thing along.
Well, I really fear that they're going to find some sort of event to justify a war with Iran. And, of course, a war, especially if this is a terrible war and it actually hits our shores, will be a very good way of rallying the American people behind the government. And this is what I fear, is they're going to come up with some pretext or other to justify going to war with Iran.
Oh,
and listen to what you're hearing on the media about how the Iranians are killing American soldiers, providing the weapons that are killing American soldiers. And, of course, you know, a lot of these roadside devices, what do they find? They were being triggered by timing devices built right here in the United States, and just accidentally that he sent to Dubai, and then of course the next thing we know are there in the roadside bombs. And you know, we've got well over 100,000 mercenaries over there working in Iraq. I wonder what they're doing. Are any of them building roadside bombs to kill American soldiers so we could justify going to war with Iran? Certainly we know that they concocted the Gulf of Tonkin incident, they concocted the sinking of the Maine. They've concocted the justification to going to war with Iraq and Afghanistan. And maybe they're going to concoct a justification for going to war with Iran. This is my fear. Anything else you wanted to say there, Jane, before we let you go?
No, that was it. I guess it's a wait and see again.
Well, these are exciting, terrifying times. Bye-bye. God bless. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we've got Gordon calling from, is that Chandler, Arizona?
Oh, this is George from Chandler, Arizona.
Okay, fine. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, Dr. Stan, I was just wondering, was Reverend Wright right about the AIDS, about him criticizing our government for creating AIDS?
Well, we don't know who created it, whether it was some clandestine secret organization, but we know it was created. There's no question. Yeah. Reverend Wright is a black racist, and I have no sympathy for him at all. But just because he said something doesn't mean that it's wrong. And yes, there's no question in my mind that AIDS is a created disease. Now, why do I say that? Well, first of all, I spent almost 10 years with an organized medicine, trying to get the organized medicine to use the standard public health techniques that could have been used back in 1986 to stop the spread of the disease, and we were blocked at every turn. It soon became very, very obvious that, you know, there was an agenda behind this. There was no justification for not doing with AIDS exactly what we'd done with syphilis in the way of, you know, routine testing and routine premarital testing and routine prenatal, that is, pregnant women testing, and neonatal testing to save the lives of the children born with HIV disease. And then, of course, all the other things we could have done, routine testing in doctor's offices and hospitals, identified who had the disease, and then, of course, done contact tracing to find out who had given the disease to the index patient and who he'd given it to. And we could have stopped this disease back in 86. We did not do that. Number one. Secondly, at the same time when this disease suddenly appeared back about 1981, as I remember, there were eight different types of the disease, eight different subtypes of the disease. There was subtype M and O, and under M there was A, B, C, D, E, and F. And then there was HIV-1 and HIV-2. Where did all of these spontaneously come from at the same time? I mean, are we to believe that they all spontaneously developed? And I don't believe that for 1 minute. And then, of course, the corker on this whole thing is that this is not simply HIV infection. That there's usually a mycoplasm with it. And who do you think holds the patent on this genetically modified mycoplasm? Why, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. And, of course, then, of course, some of the people who were involved in this and creating the disease have come forward and told the truth, and it's been very difficult for them. Gary Glum wrote a book called A Full Disclosure. That's Full Disclosure. You can still get copies up on the Internet. It's very expensive, but the book's well worthwhile getting. And hold that for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we have a caller from Chandler, Arizona, and he was asking if Reverend Wright is right when he said that this disease, AIDS, was actually created by the white man to target the blacks, and that's absolutely true. And I was simply pointing out that there's a book called Full Disclosure written by Gary Glum. And in that book, he tells about this gentleman who was dying of cancer, and it came to him for treatment, and he treated him, and basically the fellow said, "What can I do for you?" And this man had worked with intelligence. He said, "Tell me the truth about AIDS." So the man told him about how it was. He actually worked for intelligence, and how this disease was created. Certainly our good friend Dr. Garth Nicholson says that he's talked to at least one person from the dark side of government who admits that he was part of the group that created this disease. You can go to Boyd Graves' website. He has a lot of information up there on how this disease was created. It was created actually by the CIA. They actually employed doctors all across this country. Each one, of course, part of the whole puzzle. Most of them had no idea what they were working on. But they wanted to create a new disease that would destroy the immune system for which there'd be no treatment. And it's specifically targeted, as Reverend Wright says, towards blacks. How do we know that? Well, you look at the latest statistics that are available from the CDC for the year 2006. And you'll find out, as I remember, there were 150,000 people living with AIDS in America who are white, 190,000 people living in America who are black, and about 80,000 living in America who are Hispanic. So certainly the blacks are the vast majority, even though they only make up 10% of the population. You go to Africa, you go into Botswana, and we have these figures from the U.S. Census Bureau, where we're carefully monitoring the epidemic to see what a great job we're doing. In Botswana, 46% of the pregnant women are infected. They're all going to die. That's either the greatest public health tragedy of all time, or the most successful black genocidal policy of all time.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Dr. Boyd Graves. I watched a lecture of him this afternoon, and I couldn't believe it. He mentioned that there's a U.S. patent for a cure of AIDS, and I went to the U.S. patent website and typed in the patent number, and it pops right up.
But you see, they don't want to treat AIDS. They don't want to save the lives of the people. The real agenda is population control. As incredible as it may seem, how could anybody be that crass and indifferent? And yet, of course, we have the quotation from Jacques Cousteau in the November 1991 UNESCO Courier to saying that we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. And anybody wants to see those pages from the UNESCO Courier, we have them. We'd be glad to provide them for people. This is not imaginary. It's real. You need to go to my website, radioliberty.com, and pull down our Population Control Agenda monograph. And even though there's much more information there that we could put in it today, but it's still the best thing that's out there. I mean, look at tobacco and the number of people it kills. And what are we doing? We're subsidizing the growing of tobacco here in the United States. And yet it's one of the greatest killers we have. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
You see, it really doesn't make sense unless you understand there is another agenda.
Yeah, and it's another group called WeAreChange.org just recently confronted Ted Turner, and Ted Turner flat out admits that we need to have a one-child policy for the world.
Right, of course, but he's got, I don't know how many kids himself, but
yeah.
He's got a lot of kids himself, but he wants the rest of, you see, he's part of the elite. That's the problem, is Ted Turner is part of the elite, and they have one set of values for the elite, like he and Al Gore and John Kerry and George W. Bush, the Bush family. And then there's, of course, another thing for us common folks. Well, one of the best sources of information you can get off the Internet is called NSSM 200, National Security Study Memorandum 200. It was put out in 1974, over the name of Henry Kissinger. It laid out America's basic foreign policy, and it was all about population control. Originally, it was top secret. It's been declassified. It's available on the Internet. If you don't have the Internet, you can purchase it from Radio Liberty. It's very important to understand that the plan has always been to kill off most of the people in other countries. And, of course, what they don't tell you is doing it right here in the United States. I mean, why do you think we've had an explosion of cancer? Where, certainly back in the early part of the last century, one person in 33 developed cancer for 1900. Today, one person in two develops a cancer, and many of them are going to die of them. Why is that? Well, very simply, they're using cancer to kill people off, and there are treatments for it that are being withheld, just as there are treatments for AIDS. And let me suggest to anybody who doubts that this is true, we have a wonderful four-tape set. It's an interview with Dr. Dunnigan, who is in Pittsburgh, comes from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he tells you about a lecture he attended back in 1969, where they actually, the former head of medicine, the medical department of Planned Parenthood, told about the fact that they had treatments for cancer, and they were going to be actually kept in the basement of the Rockefeller Foundation. In other words, they have no intention of coming up with effective treatments. They're going to do a lot of things. An awful lot of people are going to die. But aren't there really too many people in the world? I don't believe that. I believe between man's plan and time and God's plan and eternity, there's an infinite quantity of difference. And it's not up to you and I to determine who lives and who dies. But the Rockefellers and the elite want to determine that. And they really intend to kill off most of the world's population. And if you haven't seen my talk on Nundare College genocide or planned population reduction or population control, you need to get that information and the other information we have. They're very, very blatant in what they intend to do. Anything? Oh, and the other excellent source is Alex Jones' DVD, Endgame.
Yeah, that's excellent. I've seen that already.
Okay, we're going to have to let you go. Is there anything else you want to say?
Thanks for a great show, Dr. Stan, and keep up the good fight.
We will, as long as God gives us breath. God bless. Thanks so much. All right, again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. It's Open Line Wednesday, and if you have something you'd like to talk about, give us a call. Otherwise, let's go to Maggie from Hill Country of Texas. You live in the Hill Country, huh?
Yeah, in that area.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, Dr. Stan. I recently had the opportunity to attend an international conference on the so-called New Urbanism, which is, as you know, that scheme for developing, well, making large-scale developments of housing and so on, some of it upscale, some of it affordable, and creating sort of bogus little towns.
No, is this sort of a sustainable development concept?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Okay. How did you happen to go to that?
I don't know how I got on the mailing list to be invited to that, but I had the chance to volunteer for it.
All right, fine. What did you learn, Maggie?
I learned quite a lot, and I recorded a great deal of it. There was the chance to take what they called New Urbanism 101. That's what I wanted above all, because I just wanted a ground-up explanation of what this was all about. And among the things I found were that some of the people supporting this seem to be really of goodwill and really believing their story that they're telling themselves about how wonderful this is. And other people, I assume, are going along because they're paid to go along. But at the very top, they know what's going on. And in particular, many of the sessions were led by the man who's supposed to be sort of the chief proselytizer of this. The big man at the top today, his name is Andre Duany, I believe it's pronounced. And he was talking about it in one session, and he made this comment. He said, new urbanism is the result of 100 years of planning. And then he said, the only other thing that would take more planning will be a one-world religion. That will take 200 years. And he just threw that in, and then he said it again.
Well, he must have been listening to Radio Liberty. Cause
a one-world religion will take 200 years, he said. And so he knows what it's all about. Among the other things, the other features of this conference was a special video from Prince Charles himself. It was played on a huge screen TV since he couldn't be there in person, and he joked about not wanting to use his own planes because, of course, he was being sustainable. And
let me tell you, the Prince Charles really believes in what he's saying. And he gets out and he rides his bicycle every morning. Of course, a whole entourage are behind him in automobiles, but he is simply riding a bicycle so he won't have to drive in a car and pollute the environment. Prince Charles is one of the major architects of this whole thing. In fact, the ruling elite, this gets right back to the Club of Rome back in the early 1970s. Of course, this whole idea of sustainable development, The Limits to Growth was a book that they put out, and this then became sort of the Mein Kampf of this whole environmental movement, the sustainable development, Agenda 21, but it's really all about control. They're not interested at all, of course, in the environment. They want our forests to burn, they want to kill off the animals, but they keep talking about how you have to love trees and love flowers, and it's all about control. When you understand that, there's no problem facing it today that a new series of government controls won't solve. At least they tell us it's going to solve it. And, of course, the truth of the matter is there's no problem facing us today that a new government program won't make worse.
Oh, yeah, yes. One more thing I want to point out. I'm not really doing a very good job of conveying this because the topic is so vast, but several people actually admitted to some concern about food, and there was one man in particular. I think his name is Farr, F-A-R-R. He's one of the main honchos in all this, and I was in a panel where he spoke, and I talked to him later privately, and I said, well, you know, these little towns with their little town centers and nice landscape grounds and cash register retail areas and so on are all very nice, but what about the just-in-time food system? Because food is theoretically, by your own admission, supposed to come from a hinterlands which surrounds the town, And that doesn't happen anymore. We have a just-in-time food system that's bringing everything in from the coast. And he said something like, I worry about that too. So several of them just up and admitted it.
Well, I think, of course, we are in for some very real problems. I believe that there's going to be famine throughout the world. Mm-hmm. I think eventually there's going to be famine here, and people better understand that. We are seeing, of course, the fulfillment of Revelation 6:8. And I look, and behold, a pale horse, and the rider upon him was death, and Hades followed close behind, and power was given unto them to kill a quarter of the population of the world by the sword and by suddenly pestilence and by famine and by the beasts of the world. And basically that is really what the plan is. You can read about it in the original text of Barbara Mark Savage's book, The Revelation, the Book of Co-Creation, which when it was eventually published was put out by the Lawrence Rockefeller Endowment for the Humanities. But in the original manuscript, which we have copies, we've gotten from several places, so I know that they're accurate. Why, of course, she talked about Barbara Mark Savage, one of the richest women in the world, actually the heiress of the Marx toy fortune. And, of course, with fabulous amounts of money, she writes about, talking about Revelation 6:8, the killing of a quarter of the world's population. That is not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the riders of the pale horse, death. And those are her words. Anybody wants to see those pages, we'll be glad to prescribe them or provide them. Telephone number 1-800-544-8927. Understand that we're dealing with people who really, of course, have no compassion for humanity. Anything else, Maggie?
No, except would you be interested for me to send you some of those quotes? Or
I would love for you to give me those quotes.
Or some of those recordings with the area marked?
I wish I had the time to listen to the recordings.
With the point marked.
All right, fine. Yes, I would love to get them from you. And thank you so very much. And how are you listening to, a shortwave or Internet?
I can listen to both. Tonight I happen to be listening on Internet, but I often do hear you on shortwave, and you come in very well.
All right, thank you so very much. Well, we're pleased with our new evening shortwave provider. Wish
it
we could do
very
it
well,
both
yes.
Good night, God
bless. Good night.
Okay, fine. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, it's Open Line Wednesday. It's certainly one of my high points of my week. Well, of course, we're finding now oil approaching $120 a barrel. And, of course, we've already mentioned that there's plenty of oil out there. All you hear about is peak oil, peak oil, peak oil. We're running out of oil. It's a finite commodity. Basically, we have enough coal here, and it can be converted into oil to last us for a couple of hundred years, even at the current rates of consumption. But, of course, we have tremendous supplies up in the Arctic Anwar, they call it, up in the Alaska Wildlife Area. And for years, they've wanted to drill there, and they will not let them. Why? Because the oil companies, do you mean to tell me you honestly believe the oil companies want to drill up there and they can't buy off the senators and the congressmen? No, they're paying them not to vote for it. Why? Because the price goes up when there's shortages. And it's simply a law of supply and demand. If there's a shortage, the price goes up. If there's an excess, the price goes down. What do you think the oil companies really want? Do you think, of course, they want shortages and higher prices, or abundance and lower prices? Well, and that's why, of course, Exxon made more money in the last quarter of last year than any other corporation at any time in history. Well, let's go to Mikey calling from Santa Cruz. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yeah, Mikey.
Oh, Mikey. Okay, is that M-I-K-E?
That's good.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, do you have a question or comment?
I just wanted to see if you'd talk about righteous pirating.
About what now?
Righteous pirating.
Well, you're going to have to tell me what righteous pirating is, because I'm not going to talk about
well,
it.
Well, there's stealing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's righteous pirating.
I see. Well, of course, I'm against stealing of any sort, I believe.
Well, sure, so am I.
Okay, so...
The other thing is that, the Jesus Christ Heavenly Father...
Right.
The Keeper of the Stars, I'm believing that his his wife, the first wedding, is the Holy Ghost, you know, his good helper.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what does that have to do with righteous pirating?
Oh, I'm just throwing some things out there.
Okay, fine. Well, I appreciate so much your... anything else you want to say before we let you go?
Jeremiah 3:3-11.
All right, fine. God bless. Thanks very much, Mike. Appreciate your call.
You too.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we're drawing towards the end of the program. If you're out there and you'd like to give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. But it's fascinating if you follow this whole concept of peak oil, where it came from. And it came from Dr. Hubert. And Dr. Hubert back in the 1950s was talking about peak oil. And in fact, he had a bell-shaped curve, and he talked about how the top of the curve, the bell curve, was the peak that was came to be known as Hubert's peak, and that was the point where we began to run out of oil here in the United States. And of course, this was anticipated that this actually would occur early in 1971. Now, remember, the prediction was originally made in 1955, and yet he, certainly Dr. Hubert, who worked for Shell Oil Company, said that the America would stop producing oil, or would be producing less oil than we used starting in 1971, and would begin having to increase our oil imports. And you'd never guess what happened. It's exactly what happened. 1971, America's oil production peaked. But the question is, why does it peak? And of course, the reason it did was because the oil companies were financing the environmental movement. And the environmental movement, of course, shut down the efforts to drill oil in this country, to build new refineries, to compete with the existing oil refineries, but mainly to make it literally impossible for us to drill offshore, to drill in federal lands, to drill up in Alaska. And they engineered this whole incredible shortage of oil. And if you haven't got our 4 tapes out on oil, let me recommend that you do that. You really need to get Lindsay Williams' book, The Energy Non-Shortage, to see that this whole thing is contrived. There's plenty of oil in Alaska, in the Aleutians, off the north shore of Alaska, but they don't want that. And they want you to believe we're running out of oil, the earth is running out of oil, and they repeat this over and over and over again. A lot of my good friends believe it. Now, I'm not saying there's not a problem, but it's a problem because they have blocked the oil drilling for such a long period of time, and it'll probably take us 5 to 10 years to begin to rectify, if we still have a free country, to begin to rectify the problems that have been intentionally created by the environmental movement, which was funded by the oil companies. It's about time people woke up and began to understand that everything that we're seeing today is contrived. Reality is usually scoffed at, and illusion is usually king. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, if you will, why, of course, we'd love to welcome you, and you can do that simply by calling 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you'd like to understand the so-called oil shortage, let me suggest the 4-tape set that we have on oil. And I think it's quite well done. And then, of course, we have my newsletters, the September and October of the year 2005. You can get them off our Internet site, or if you request them, we'll be glad to send them to you. But go to our Internet site at RadioLiberty.com, pull down my September and October newsletters, and they'll give you tremendous insight into what's going on. And then, of course, we hope that you'll want to get Lindsay Williams' book, The Energy Non-Crisis. If you're interested, of course, in the death of Martin Luther King, we have a great new 4-tape or 4-CD set entitled, Who Executed Martin Luther King? And, of course, we have a book that goes along with that. It's called An Active State. And, of course, it was simply a government hit. Why? Because Martin Luther King was opposing the Vietnam War, and they wanted to continue it going for a longer period of time. Martin Luther King was talking about leading a march on Washington, D.C. They couldn't allow that. I mean, certainly Martin Luther King was a charismatic leader. He was far better off as a dead martyr than as a live hero opposing the establishment. So after they used him, they simply had him killed. And the story is beautifully told in our four-tape set. You'll never hear this elsewhere. You won't hear about the trial where the King family actually brought charges against one of the assassins, who then admitted he was part of the hit team that had killed Martin Luther King. So if I could suggest that new DVD, Who Executed Martin Luther King, we think it's very, very important. Then, of course, we certainly recommend our talk on the planned police state, because it will take you not only to their plans, but the spirits of forces behind those plans. And if you get the syllabus that goes with that, you'll actually see some of the publications put out by the people on the other side. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really is another side. Well, we've got, I remember our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and we've got Sandra calling from Blythe. Hi, Sandra, how are you doing?
How are you?
I'm doing fine. You've only got about 30 seconds, so.
Way to Russia. Do you remember the name of it and the name of the treaty, and are they going to give the Aleutians away, too? I'll get off the line and listen to you.
No, are you speaking, of course, about Wrangel Island? There was talk some time ago about turning Wrangel Island with its massive oil deposits. And it's certainly halfway between the Aleutians and, the Soviet mainland there in Siberia. And then, of course, yes, of course, we're doing everything we can to build up the Soviet Union. For those of you who have not read my Communist Capitalist Alliance, just a little pamphlet, it's made up of a number of our newsletters. I think they were, the newsletters, the Communist Capitalist Alliance, five newsletters, got information there you won't read elsewhere. We financed the communists since their inception. We financed China since its inception. And we financed North Korea. We can always find an excuse for sending them more money, for sending them oil, for building nuclear reactors for them, for sending them food, to keep the tyrannical government in power. But we can't let the American people understand that. We've got to think, well, we're bargaining with them so they won't build nuclear weapons, or so they'll stop building more nuclear weapons, or... No, ladies and gentlemen, we're keeping this a terrible government in power, just as we're keeping the terrible government in Zimbabwe in power that is slaughtering and killing and torturing the people. And, of course, then they're being kept in power with food from the United Nations, which we pay for. We pay 25% or more of those expenses. And then, of course, we fund communist China, and they're keeping Mugabe in power. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, former editor of the New American Magazine, and now certainly working with the Welch Foundation. And, of course, he writes their blog. He writes a regular blog. He writes for them. He lectures, just back from a Southern California lecture. He's written a book. I've written a number of books. The latest one is Liberty in Eclipse, or The Eclipse of Liberty. Is it Liberty in Eclipse? All right, fine. And of course, we carry the book. It's important because it goes into this whole idea that we're moving towards a police state. This is not imaginary, ladies and gentlemen. This is not scare talk. This is the reality of what is really going on in the world today. Without further ado, William Grigg, thank you so much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, thanks for having me.
Well, what are we going to talk about this evening?
I think it would be worthwhile to do a tour of the horizon this evening and take a look at several things that constitute what I call the great unraveling, or to use the fancy French expression, le grand dénouement. What we're seeing, as we pointed out on many occasions here, is the unwinding not only of a whole system of fiat currency and debt that has been the foundation of this imperial socialist regime we live under, both nationally and globally, but also the unraveling of a lot of the other political and economic entities that hold the system together. And I think a good place to start would be with the front page story from today's USA Today, which confirms something that you and I have talked about with respect to the decline of our once free republic into unabashed socialism. People often dispute or debate over the question of at what point a society could be called socialist. At what point does the government's portion of the gross domestic product reach a threshold where you can say that socialism exists? I contend that full-fledged socialism exists in any country where the government is the largest employer. It doesn't have to be the majority employer. It has to be the largest employer of all the contending sources of employment. We've reached that point. And today's USA Today is a front page story with the anodyne headline, Hiring Leaps in Public Sector. For public sector, we read government. And the story says, the federal, state, and local governments are hiring new workers at the fastest pace in 6 years, helping to offset job losses in the private sector. That, by the way, isn't true. The government of any kind is a purely consumptive entity. It doesn't produce anything of social value. It neither knits nor spins. It makes neither butter nor shoes nor poetry, to use the expression from Sinclair Lewis's novel Babbitt. What government does is it produces coercion. It consumes wealth and it produces coercion. That's not a socially productive function. So they're not offsetting job losses in the private sector. What they're doing is they're exacerbating the economy and the economic problems that are creating job losses. But to continue now with the story, governments added 76,800 jobs in the first 3 months of 2008, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's the biggest jump in first quarter hiring since a boom in 2002 that followed the 9/11 terrorist attacks. By contrast, private companies collectively shed 286,000 workers in the first 3 months of 2008. That job loss has led many economists to declare that the country is in a recession. Later this afternoon, after the story was published, the Bush regime put out a report claiming that first quarter growth in the United States was barely into positive territory, that we supposedly grew at 0.6% for the first quarter of this year.
That, of course, totally ignores inflation, and with a 12%
yes.
inflation, well, of course, you can imagine how far we're going behind.
Yeah,
we'll be back in just a moment here with William Grigg. As he talked about the certainly one of the largest employers in the world, in the country today, our own government.
Yeah, what you pointed out with respect to the supposed growth in the economy being nullified by inflation, of course, is entirely true. And the way that they calculate economic growth factors in as growth certain elements of debt, and of course debt grew considerably, and so to the extent that you can say that debt represents a form of economic growth, you could say the economy is growing by 0.6%, but that of course once again doesn't take into account the real rate of inflation, which is somewhere probably around at least 12% annually if you take a look at the real pressures that are put on prices and the real growth in the money supply. We're talking something in at least the realm of 12%.
Yeah, could I make a suggestion for our listeners? That's shadowstatistics.com, shadowstatistics.com, John Williams' website, already gives you the real inflation rate. And then, of course, the M3, which the government refuses to print because they realize if you knew that, of course, we were going to have a 17 to 18% inflation by the end of the year, some of you might be realize, of course, we're well on the way to the destruction of our economic system. But
yeah.
Please go ahead, William.
That's a very important website to go to because this is a fellow who crunches the numbers and presents them in a digestible form that show what's really going on with respect to the growth of the money supply, the real rate of inflation, and the underpinnings of this economic disaster that's unfolding in real time before our eyes. With respect to the hiring here that we're talking about, the boom we're discussing began last July 1st, according to USA Today, when most state and local governments started new fiscal years. Those budgets were based on forecasts established in a strong economy. Each quarter since, the total government workforce has been the most in at least 6 years. Now, there's reference made to the post-9/11 hiring boom on the part of the federal government. That's something that is still, of course, rippling through the economy and creating all these dislocations. We don't train engineers in this country anymore. There's a shortage of engineers in the various applied sciences that have to do with maintaining industrial economy. We train all kinds of engineers for other countries. We train Chinese engineers by the tens of thousands, engineers from India and elsewhere in that part of the world, in Asia. But we don't train many American engineers in large measure because they cannot earn a wage that would make them competitive and put them in a bracket where they could provide for a family and some degree of upward mobility, given the competition that they've been thrown into against people in India and China and elsewhere that make a fairly modest percentage of what an American engineer would have to make in order to make a decent living. But we do train people for homeland security. That is the growth stock right now in academics and higher education. All the fields relative to the creation of this homeland security state that I talk about in my new book, Liberty and Eclipse.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Somebody want to know the website I'd refer to, it's called Shadow Statistics, www.shadowstatistics.com, I believe. And anyway, of course, William Grigg is talking about one of the greatest growth industries in America is the Office of Homeland Security. They're taking on all sorts of people to protect us from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's, in my estimation, probably been dead for a number of years. But we have to have an enemy so the American people will rally behind the government to protect us. And of course, every now and then, of course, we get a picture of Osama bin Laden or a recording of Osama bin Laden. And the CIA always insists that it really is Osama bin Laden. We know it's Osama bin Laden. We can just trust us, you know. Well, we've trusted them too long. But anyway, I said we justify the Office of Homeland Security because Osama bin Laden wants to take away our freedom. And yet, of course, what we're doing, tragically, is having our own government take away our freedom in the name of protecting us from Osama bin Laden. Go right ahead, William.
Exactly. Osama bin Laden, at one point, being a subcontractor for Washington, as was Saddam Hussein, as was Manuel Noriega, as were any one of a number of reprobates and thugs that we could list. And, of course, Osama bin Laden is somebody whose image or a likeness of his image is shaken at us totemically from time to time in order to scare us into supporting the creation of a government that is rapidly sucking away what remains of our freedom and prosperity. I refer to him as the omnipotent troglodyte. We're supposed to believe that this fellow is squatting in a cave somewhere on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, assuming, of course, he's still in the mortal plane, is somebody who could take our freedoms away when, of course, we've got this metastasizing Leviathan government that is doing a very good job of it, irrespective of Osama bin Laden's existence. And Homeland Security, as I pointed out, is the growth stock right now in the academic realm. People are being trained to become Homeland Security drones and functionaries. They're not being trained here in the United States to become engineers and to produce things. They're being trained to exercise coercive power in a purely consumptive fashion, which is what government does. The creation of the Department of Homeland Security in 2002 represented the single biggest growth, the single biggest enlargement of government since the creation of the Pentagon, quite frankly, since the creation of the CIA and those elements of the military-industrial complex that were created around the CIA back in 1948. And now what we're being told is that beginning last July, we saw this radical expansion of governments, not merely federal governments, but also state and local governments. Reading a little bit more deeply here into the story by USA Today, we come across the rather astonishing fact that, I'm quoting now, the USA has nearly 88,000 units of government, mostly local, that employ 22 million people. Hiring has been strong at every level, from new CIA spies to preschool teachers. Some of what's happening includes the federal government increased its workforce by 13,800 in the first 3 months of this year. Local governments added 47,000 and state 16,000. Now, I find that astonishing, once again, because you're talking about the expansion of that element of society that represents pure consumption, destruction of capital, destruction of wealth, and ultimately destruction of liberty.
But of course, the other thing, William, is the fact that the state and the local governments don't have the money to hire these people and keep them on, because what's going to happen is certainly with decreased taxes coming in, state income taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, as many of our states are facing many, many major financial problems. Here in California, they're talking about a $20 billion deficit by July of next year.
Yeah.
How can they possibly be taking on people? They've got to start laying off all across America, and they just don't want to do it.
No, they don't want to do it. And the luxury of being the government is that when times become rather challenging and when the public purse has become impecunious, what they can do is they can simply ramp up enforcement of all the various and sundry ordinances that can nibble away at the wealth of the productive people, which is why you're seeing, as I predicted over 2 years ago, you're seeing an increase in the enforcement of all these quality of life ordinances that are used to regulate how tall, how high your grass can be in your front yard, to regulate the contents of your driveway or your backyard. You're seeing people being pestered and pilfered by the local police forces as a way of increasing revenue. Yesterday when I was in Nampa, Idaho, which is a town of about 70,000, I noticed that they had not one but two different enforcement campaigns underway to deal with such things as aggressive driving and seatbelt violations and so forth. They had the police out in force. It was amazing how many police cars I encountered in the stretch of about 20 minutes. Then when I got onto the interstate just outside of Nampa, the Nampa police within the city limits were on motorcycles looking for people to shake down for revenue. That's the sort of thing that happens when you have this metastasizing growth of local and state governments and economic decline going on at the same time. And government can always find ways of wheedling or extorting money out of people in order to pay the parasites. The other thing we need to bear in mind, of course, is that these are not independent governments. If we had 88,000 independent governments in this country that were actually independent, autonomous, constitutionally sound governments, we'd be better off than we are right now. I am reflexively critical of government. It's somewhat of a misnomer to say I'm anti-government. I would actually prefer that we have many, many governments so as to keep power subdivided. And we have governments that are small enough that when necessary, they can have their powers taken from them or be abolished outright. But what we have is 88,000 administrative units of one Leviathan state, and each and every one of them in some way or another at some level is controlled by Washington, D.C. This is particularly true of law enforcement agencies, which receive all kinds of Homeland Security grants and FEMA grants and transfers in the Pentagon that make them effective arms or appendages of the Pentagon. And it's becoming more and more true of municipal governments and state governments here, thanks to federal mandates and regulations. One other thing that we're seeing here by way of providing a steady stream of revenue for municipal governments is something that was discussed last weekend at the UROC conference, and that's the process of what is called redevelopment in California. It's called urban development, urban renewal elsewhere. It's a process through which municipal governments acting as redevelopment or urban renewal boards can use the power of eminent domain simply to seize property to be turned over to developers on the assumption that by bringing in some large economic entity that would receive favorable treatment from the municipal government in terms of tax breaks, regulatory breaks, and of course the property that's seized from private citizens, they'll be able to receive a larger revenue stream on the basis of what that commercial enterprise would earn. And in California, I was astonished to find out, a municipal government acting as a redevelopment body, once it has seized property through eminent domain, and it's very simple to do so, all they have to do is describe an area as blighted, and it can be blighted by any whimsical definition the municipal government can conjure. They could call Rodeo Drive a blight area if they wanted to in order to confiscate it through eminent domain. But once this has been accomplished and they find somebody who's able to relocate there for a commercial development, the municipal government can go out and borrow 13 times the anticipated revenue stream. And, of course, that means that you go into debt, and taxpayers are going to have to end up making up that debt, assuming that the commercial property in question doesn't produce 13 times the estimated revenue. But, of course, it's a really good deal, at least in the short term, which is how these people think, in the short term, for the government entity and the favored clientele and constituents that are part of this corrupt scheme. So we're going to be seeing a lot more of that kind of nonsense through the magic of eminent domain, which, of course, is this magical conjuration that is spoken as government steals your property from you. You're going to see a lot of this going on as a way of providing for an expanded revenue base. They'll do all kinds of things in order to dispossess us, expropriate us, impecuniate us, rather than cut the number of people who are fasting on the public teat as supposed government employees. Notice I call them employees and not workers. What they do is not socially productive. It represents a net subtraction from prosperity and freedom every time we see some of these people hired. That's a very important point when you bear in mind the fact that there is a direct causal relationship between the expansion of government, the contraction of liberty, and the growth of government on the one hand, and the destruction of our prosperity. The only way government can grow is by stealing our prosperity and our freedoms. And this is all happening at a time when the private sector, the productive sector of our country, is having to shed jobs because of the decline of the dollar and the concomitant increase in price inflation and the tightening of credit. And so you're seeing pure, unfiltered Keynesianism. Maynard Keynes' great idea was that basically, in order to offset the prospect of an economic collapse, government should go out and create so-called jobs by whatever means necessary, doing anything, no matter how pointless, to justify putting people on the public payroll. This is pure Keynesian growth in the economy. And if that amounts to this 0.6% growth that we've seen over the first 3 months of the year of 2008, that's pure Keynesian growth, and that's the type of growth we simply can't afford because in the long run it kills us.
I certainly concur, and I think that basically people have to understand that government, of course, will eventually destroy. Cicero was talking about this, you know, over 2,000 years ago when he said, you know, the budget should be balanced. Certainly the foreign adventures and foreign military actions should be limited. The arrogance of the bureaucracy should be tempered, and public spending should be limited, else Rome will go bankrupt. This is not the first time it happened. Cicero was killed, Rome went bankrupt, and the Roman Republic ended. They established their dictatorship. They called it the Roman Empire.
Exactly, and Cicero was somebody who was a model Roman statesman. He certainly wasn't a Christian in terms of his ethics, but in terms of the way he approached politics, he displayed the virtues of the old Roman Republic. And when he had insulted the tyrant Marcus Antony by delivering, I believe it was 24 or 36 speeches he called the Philippics, criticizing the corrupt ambitions of the man who would be dictator following Caesar, and Marcus Antonius sent his minions out to grab Cicero off of a boat in which he tried to flee. And not only did Marcus Antonius have Cicero beheaded, he had his right hand smitten off. That was the hand he'd used to write those speeches. And Cicero's insights about the relationship between imperial politics abroad and the destruction of liberty and prosperity at home, of course, are timeless and deathless, and they're of immediate relevance to what we're seeing right now.
Hold that thought. All right, go right ahead, William. I agree with you totally. And, of course, I just wish young people today could read Cicero, could understand what his warnings were and how applicable they are to the very day in which we live.
Exactly. There really has not been any innovations I can think of in human nature over the last 2,000 years. There haven't been any refinements to the laws of economics that I'm aware of, any more than there have been any changes to the law of gravity. We might understand those laws a little bit better, but the laws themselves remain unchanged and consistent. And when you talk about the relationship between our declining prosperity and the expansion of the empire abroad, one really good example of that was a news item from today talking about how, at long last, it is official that the government of Iran, which is the second largest oil producer in the OPEC cartel, has stopped conducting oil transactions in U.S. dollars. That was confirmed today by a top oil ministry official from Tehran. This was described by CNN as a concerted attempt to reduce reliance on Washington at a time of tension over Tehran's nuclear program and suspected involvement in Iraq. I have long said, as a matter of fact, I think I started talking about this in late 2005 or early 2006, that if and when we end up in a shooting war with Iran, the trigger is going to be Iran's dumping of the dollar as the currency of choice in oil transactions. And, of course, the figurehead president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, has referred to the dollar, the ever-depreciating dollar, as a, quote, worthless piece of paper when he was at a summit last year in Saudi Arabia that was attended by other representatives of OPEC countries, including Hugo Chavez from Venezuela. Of course, Ahmadinejad, who is many things, most of them thoroughly contemptible, is not a fool, and he understands the logic of dollar depreciation. Why should they be selling something worthwhile, one of the most prized commodities on the planet, in exchange for a gaudily decorated piece of paper or its digital equivalent that is constantly losing whatever subjective value it has? And of course, the important thing here, once again, is that Iran is the second largest producer of oil in the OPEC cartel. The largest is Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, since the early 1970s, have been keeping the dollar afloat by making it the currency of the default currency for oil transactions, which means that it has been exchanged for something worthwhile. We've effectively had a petrodollar, a dollar which is backed up by OPEC petroleum. And now you're seeing the second largest producer saying we're not going to have anything to do with the dollar. And this happens, of course, at a time when the Bush administration once again is ramping up the bellicose rhetoric with respect to Iran. There's another aircraft carrier that's been sent to the Persian Gulf, which is becoming quite a crowded bathtub by now. There was an episode recently, just in the last couple of days, involving an encounter between a speedboat and a vessel that is aligned with the U.S. but operated by private contractors operating in international waters. Shots were fired and ambiguous stories were exchanged as to who was responsible for commencing hostilities. And today, CBS is reporting that that second American aircraft carrier steamed into the Persian Gulf just yesterday as the Pentagon has ramped up its criticism of Iran for smuggling weapons into Iraq for use against American troops. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said the following: what the Iranians are doing is killing American servicemen and women in Iraq. Robert Gates was saying that this is intolerable, and summarizing Gates' remarks, CBS said, no attacks are imminent, no attacks on Iran are imminent, and the last thing the Pentagon wants is another war. But Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, has warned Iran not to assume the U.S. military can't strike. I have reserve capability, in particular our Navy and our Air Force, so it would be a mistake to think that we are out of combat.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. And, of course, our guest is William Grigg. And William, simply talking about all the things that are suggest that we're preparing for a war with Iran. Now, we have our other sources of information. Well, it certainly concur with what William's saying, whether it be, of course, we see moving another aircraft carrier into the Persian Gulf. We hear our leaders talking about how, of course, the Iranians are providing weapons that are killing American boys. And, of course, the patriotic thing to do, well, the inference is that if they're killing American boys, we should, of course, retaliate against Iran. Is it true? The Iranians claim that it's not true at all. But how do we know it's true at all? We know, of course, the Gulf of Tonkin incident was totally contrived to get us into the Vietnam War. And 58,000 American boys died in Italy, needlessly. We know, of course, the sinking of the Maine back in 1898 was totally contrived, you know, to get us into that war, into the Spanish-American War. We know, of course, the facts about Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda, you know, they had to lie to us to get us into the war with Afghanistan, because if we really went there for to get Osama bin Laden when he was gone, why did we keep on fighting in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
And now, of course, they lied to us to get it into the Iraq war. Why would we think that they would not, of course, come up with a contrived excuse to get us into Iran? And you pick up the story.
Yeah, that is exactly what's happening. They're looking for a contrived excuse to get involved in Iran. I think that the real casus belli would be the Iranian government's decision to dump the dollar as the instrument of choice, the financial instrument to conduct the oil transactions. But in any case, the obvious intention of the Bush administration is to get us involved in a war with Iran, and right now we're being told that the escalation of violence, I mean, I believe this past month has been perhaps the worst month, this month of April has been the worst month in terms of violent attacks on American troops and Iraqi forces aligned with American troops in Iraq. We found that the so-called secure green zone in Baghdad, which is the headquarters for the occupation and the diplomatic corps in Baghdad, is anything but secure. Just yesterday, and it infuriates me almost to the point of tears to describe this, there was a funeral in Emmett, which is a town about 30 miles away from here, a small town, maybe about 25 not anywhere near that big. It's probably about 15,000 people. There's a 36-year-old father of three small girls who is a reservist in the Army and a lawyer in civilian practice. He was buried with military honors yesterday in Boise. He was one of two people who were killed in a rocket attack on the Green Zone about a month and a half ago. He leaves behind a young wife and three little girls, the oldest of whom I think is 8 years old. And he had been serving in the Green Zone, which was supposedly a secure area. But what has happened during this so-called surge is that there has been this escalation in internecine violence in the surrounding Iraqi territories here. And a lot of it has been abetted by Iran. Iran is, like the majority of Iraqis, ruled by Shiites. And it just stands to reason that once you have a majority Shiite country being allowed to exercise democratic control over a society, that they're going to align with their fellow Shiites, which is why Mahmoud Ahmadinejad can stroll around Baghdad smiling and openly in great confidence, and George W. Bush, the supposed liberator of Iraq, when he arrives, he has to do so surreptitiously under cover of darkness, and he can barely step a foot out of his airplane for security concerns that limit his mobility. But just in the last couple of weeks, and I'm quoting now from the current issue of the American Spectator magazine, embassy staffers in Baghdad have been told to remain under hardened cover as shelling by Muqtada al-Sadr's militia continues. They've traded their individual accommodations for cots in the reinforced structures. A warden message advised, quote, "Until further notice, all personnel under the authority of the chief of mission are required to wear body armor, helmet, and protective eyewear anytime they are outside of building structures in the international zone. This is the most secured place in the country." That's the condition of the people in the so-called Green Zone in Baghdad. We're being told that the so-called surge is succeeding, that security is being increased, that the Iraqis are stepping up and assuming a greater amount of responsibility for maintaining security. This, of course, is all a pile of used food. Iraq is falling apart. Iran, of course, is taking advantage of that situation, and that produces now the casus belli for the next step, which is an attack on Iran.
Well, I fear that you are absolutely right, and I think the American people have to stop and think of the implications of a war with Iran, because this could very well lead to the class of civilizations that Samuel Huntington warned us against in his classic book, The Class of Civilizations. And can you imagine going to war with the Muslim world with 1.25 billion people in it? What about all the 7 million Muslims living in America? If we went to war with Iran, what side would they be on? Are we going to put them in concentration camps? Or certainly, what does the future hold? It looks pretty We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is William Grieg. William, go ahead, pick up the story.
If you think that there are legitimate concerns about the security of our fighting men and the other American personnel in Iraq, that stands to reason on account of the fact that, as I just described, security is completely broken down, and you've got the initial stages of a tripartite civil war raging in that country, and the Green Zone, which is supposedly the most secure place in the country, is filled with people who are advised to wear body armor and protective helmets anytime they're not under hardened cover. And that's, of course, the most secure place in the country. And, of course, the solution here, if we're really concerned about the safety of our fighting men, is quite simple. There is this marvelous invention called an airplane. What we do is we send a fleet of airplanes over to Iraq, fill them up with our fighting men, and bring them home. That would, of course, solve the problem. But the last thing that the people who are running our foreign policy want is to solve the problem. They don't create, rather, they don't define their policy in terms of problems to solve. They think in terms of creating problems to justify solutions that always involve expanding the realm of the empire. And what happens, of course, is that as the empire expands, the value of our money decreases. We're paying the price, although we haven't had an overt tax increase during the war with Iraq. This war, which is probably going to end up costing something north of $3 trillion, a war that has no end in sight and that is grinding our military into powder, we're paying the price for this enterprise and foolishness every time we go to the pumps. We're paying the price every time we go to a checkout counter at the supermarket. And it's showing up, this price is showing up in some rather interesting places. I just today spoke with a fellow by the name of Art Hirschberger, who is in the retail petroleum business. He sells propane, which, as he explained to me, and this is something I didn't know, was considered a useless byproduct of refining process that creates gasoline until a number of decades ago. It wasn't understood that this propane, which is released as gasoline and refined, is something that's actually quite useful. He told me that for most of his career, which began in the late 1950s, he was paying 6 cents a gallon for propane. As late as 2001, he was spending, if my memory serves, 37 cents a gallon for propane. Today, he spends $1.87 a gallon for propane. That, in contrast with the 36 or 37 cents a gallon he was spending just in 2001. That's price inflation that represents, that demonstrates the astonishing decline in the purchasing power of the dollar. And the single biggest source of the spending, the deficit spending, that is helping to drive the dollar into oblivion.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grieg, and certainly talking about what's happened to the price of propane, which was used to be 3 cents a gallon, then it went, of course, to 37 cents a gallon. Now it's up to how much a gallon?
$1.87.
Of course, pretty soon you're going to have a choice between food or fuel. Are you going to have fuel to for your home? We use propane at our home, and it's shocking. It costs $1,400 to fill up our tank here just recently. $1,400 to fill up our propane tank. It's a good sized tank, but I mean it gets to be a lot of money. And of course, but do you want to be warm, or do you want, of course, to have enough money to buy food? And increasingly, if we're going to find the impoverishment of the American people, not by accident, but by intent. Let's go right ahead.
That's, of course, a terrible predicament for people who have large families like my own, or people who are older and who are more sensitive and more vulnerable during the winter months. When you're talking about propane, which has been a very affordable choice for a long, long time, becoming costly to the point of being almost inaccessibly expensive for a lot of people, that really is a dramatic turnaround, just in that one variable, in the anticipated standard of living for many millions of Americans. That, of course, is a reflection of this cancerous inflation, monetary inflation, that is resulting in this lethal symptom of price inflation. I do think that we're going to see a lot of really dramatic assaults on our previous standard of living that are going to translate into some really severe social unrest, which is one of the reasons I suspect why the people who rulers are so assiduously building this police state in the event that, in the very likely event that we see wholesale civil unrest and riots over a number of these things. I mean, when people get hungry and cold, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Americans or Latin Americans, Africans or Asians or people of any other stripe, creed, or hue, they tend to get truculent and restive, and the result, of course, would be some really ugly spectacles, the likes of which we've not seen in this country since the last time we faced an economic catastrophe of this sort back in the late 20s and early 1930s. One of the really interesting indicators here of our economic decline, leading indicator many people don't appreciate, is something that represents another volatile element in the mix, and that is the question of illegal immigration, specifically from Mexico, as measured in the number of people who are being apprehended coming here illegally and the amount of money that they're sending back to Mexico in terms of remittances. That is the single biggest source of revenue for Mexico is remittances. The second largest is drug trafficking, but the largest is remittances from Mexican workers who come here to the United States, whether legally or illegally, or naturalized American citizens who were born in Mexico who are sending money back to their families. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute points out something that I've been looking for this because when he mentioned this a year ago in a piece that he wrote for the Mises Institute, I thought that it was a really useful insight on what's going on in the economy and the way that the housing bubble created by the Federal Reserve was related to illegal immigration. The amount of money, says Mark Thornton, sent home by Mexican workers, that is remittances, peaked in the spring of 2006 and has declined 17% by the winter quarter of this year. The size of the average remittance actually peaked between the bursting of the home building stock bubble in July 2005 and the initial recognition of the housing bubble by the mainstream media in early 2006, and remittances have declined by 30%. The steep decline in remittances indicates that Mexican workers are earning less money, have fewer jobs, and may be starting to return to Mexico. Statistics from the U.S. Border Patrol indicate that despite increased enforcement efforts, the number of illegal Mexicans that have been detained has decreased by 50% between 2005 and 2007. The number of non-Mexicans, mostly Central Americans, that have been detained has decreased by almost 60%. How many illegal immigrants actually return home is anyone's guess, but as the U.S. sinks deeper and deeper into recession, especially industries that supply the most jobs to illegals, the less likely that Mexicans will cross into the U.S., and the more likely that illegals will go home. That's a very important point here, because what drew illegals here in record numbers was the proliferation of construction jobs that accompanied the housing bubble. It was very common to see people migrate here without government permission to come here illegally in or along the border in Texas and Arizona and so forth, and end up following the booming housing and construction industry, whether that took them up to the northeast or up to the northwest or over to California. That's more or less what happened. They were drawn here by the inflationary bubble. That bubble having burst, a lot of them were returning home to Mexico. And I don't know how long they'd stay there, quite frankly, because once the remittances begin to dry up, Mexico's economy is going to tank. These are people who are used to doing with less than most Americans, but still, if you talk about the utter collapse of the Mexican economy, things could end up becoming even more chaotic, because we have a welfare system in this country that does provide not only a safety net, but sort of a catch-and-retain net for people who come here illegally in many instances. And, you know, Ron Paul has pointed out that actually if you apply rational analysis to the problem of illegal immigration, you're talking about a problem of economic incentives and perverse incentives created by the welfare state. And if you change the incentives, the problem will become one that would probably be more manageable than what we have right now. But what we have right now is the worst of all possible worlds. We've got a government that has a policy that acts as a giant magnet to draw immigrants north from Mexico, while at the same time, in the name of fighting this problem, the government is either created or exacerbated. It is acquiring more and more overt police state powers and exercising them against American citizens. And one of the really spectacular examples of this nonsense in action is this proposal to build the border fence along the southern border of the United States, which strikes me as a as an impossibility. I really don't see how we're physically going to secure that entire stretch of border unless we somehow hermetically seal the entire United States beneath some kind of an impenetrable dome or something of that sort. But what's happening is that in the name of building this border fence, through, once again, eminent domain, that magic phrase used to justify the government theft of your property, people along the border in Arizona and Texas, many of whom have complained about the problem of illegal immigration, are being threatened and face the prospect of being thrown off their own property or having their property bisected in such a way that the most productive element of it ends up in the Mexican territory, in the border areas in Texas. Brownsville, Texas in particular, there are a number of other communities. There are people who are American citizens going back several generations who have inherited property that was secured under the terms of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo after the U.S.-Mexican War in 1848. These people have land patents often to go back to grants that were issued by the King of Spain, but that were recognized here in the United States after the border was regularized between the United States and Mexico following the Mexican-American War. And these people, in many instances, are being told that they have to accommodate this fence, that their property is going to be seized for the fence's construction, and they suddenly find that their agricultural fields or other assets are going to be on the southern part of the territory, that the fence will cut them off from access to their own fields, their own lands, their own places of employment, and suddenly, in spite of the fact that these are people who are born and raised in the United States, and their property has always been part of the United States of America through the creation of the border fence, those properties are going to be seized from them and end up in Mexico.
But of course the thing is it's impossible for me to believe that they could be doing this unintentionally.
Exactly.
Certainly if this was actually in part of the United States, why don't they build the fence at the southern border of their property rather than bifurcate it? It almost looks like they are intentionally trying to antagonize the people down there and so that they'll have justification for not putting in a fence.
Yeah, that's another possibility, too. I really think that the whole purpose of this campaign to build a fence, and they're not talking about finishing it anytime soon, is to provide yet another roundabout subsidy to a number of corporatist interests that are part of the military-industrial homeland security complex. I mean, if you take a look at the people who are involved in this, you find familiar names like General Electric and Raytheon and McDonnell Douglas and all these other people who regularly feast at the taxpayer trough when they're building assets for the Pentagon that are used in these wars of emancipation and empire, however you want to characterize their demented foreign policy. But they've now taken out interest in the so-called homeland security sector, and they're all involved in building this fence and providing sensors for it, things of that sort. I really believe that what's going to happen is that at some point we're going to end up seeing this program grind to a halt without the fence being completed. And I really can't understand the logic of building a fence while at the same time moving toward a North American Union that would make that border completely inconsequential in terms of the freedom of movement across it. I mean, if we have a North American Union where the United States and Mexico are, for all intents and purposes, part of one nation state, then having an enforceable border between the United States and Mexico makes about as much sense as having a border of that sort between Oregon and Idaho. I mean, I live 3 miles away from the Oregon border, I cross the Snake River and I'm in Oregon. There's not a fence separating the state of Oregon from the state of Idaho because we're part of the same political union.
But of course, William, we would like to see this effort for the North American Union defeated. And
exactly.
You know, fence have been used for a long time. The Chinese built something called the Great Wall of China. I said the India is building a 2,000-mile, 2,500-mile long fence between India and Bangladesh. It just keeps the people out. Don't you think that, Sydney, the fence would discourage the people from coming into this country? And since the government refuses to enforce our laws, which they should be doing against the employers who are employing the illegal immigrants, certainly this is at least one way to slow down some of the immigration. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I don't think it'll work. I mean, the problem I have, and I've seen a lot of photographs and follow this very carefully, is that often you'll have what looks to be like a picket fence at a place that's very close to a familiar border crossing. There's one place in San Diego, for instance, where the fence runs up all the way to the beach and then it stops. And I really don't see where, unless you're going to concentrate forces there at that beach, that you're going to deter people from going around it, just doing an end run around it. I mean, I think we're not talking about the Great Wall of China here. I think we're talking about the Maginot Line, the way that it's being erected. And there are a lot of people who are either desperate or vicious, if you will, who display a lot of depraved creativity in terms of getting here illegally and staying here illegally. And the single biggest population, if I remember correctly, among people who are here illegally are those who come here legally then overstay their visas. And the border fence isn't going to stop those people. And so I think that really we're taking a look at a classic boondoggle here. It has a certain appeal because people understandably want to do something to slow down this traffic and believe that it would be a worthwhile thing to erect a physical barrier on the assumption that it would slow them down. It's just that the enforcement measures which are being undertaken otherwise are so ludicrously porous that I don't think that the physical fence is going to stop them. And I really don't think that the same people who are promoting this dreadful idea of a North American Union would be building a fence unless they thought it would serve some purpose compatible with the merger of the United States and Mexico. And, I mean, we need to find some way of clarifying exactly what's going on so that that makes sense. We have to defeat the North American Union. We have to defund the effort to create it. We have to go through and find the funding measures that are being used to create these executive-level committees that are knitting the executive branch of the United States with the governments of Mexico and Canada. And then we need to find out what exactly they intend to do with this fence. Is it a matter of keeping them out or fencing us in? I really think that the latter is what they're up to rather than the former.
Well, I don't think many Americans would want to escape into Mexico, although who knows, things may get so bad here that this would become a reality. But certainly, there are many, many parts of this issue. One of them, of course, is English as the official language of the United States. They tried, I remember, when Senator Hayakawa here at California certainly went back to Washington, D.C. and tried to have English the official language of the United States, and he couldn't understand why there was all the opposition. Well, the reason there was opposition was they wanted us to be a multicultural and a multilingual society. They wanted to bring in massive numbers of people from South America and from Muslim countries and Hindu countries. They wanted to destroy the very structure of our society. They're doing a great job of it. Until we understand that the people who are working behind the scenes have a different agenda because they have a different worldview. And their goal is a one-world government, a one-world religion, and eventually the installation and enthronement of a one-world leader with a ruling oligarchy. Once we understand that, everything that's going on makes sense.
Yeah, and once you understand that, particularly with respect to this issue of multiculturalism, there is a concerted effort here to fund and exacerbate these divisions as a way of creating an unmanageable social structure that can only be held together through coercion. I remember that... former Secretary of State Warren Christopher, who's the man most responsible for ruining the LAPD, which was once, well, not the most, I mean, there's a lot of competition. I mean, Tom Bradley played a significant role there, too, but Warren Christopher played a very large role in destroying what had been probably the world's most properly esteemed local police force in the LAPD. But, you know, after performing that service for mankind, Warren Christopher served as the Secretary of State under Bill Clinton during their first term. And I remember reading about the visit that he made to Bosnia, the former Yugoslavia, in 1995. Bosnia, of course, was the site of some of the most horrendous internecine fighting that we've seen. It was like Lebanon cubed and then cubed again in terms of the bloodshed, as you had Croats and Bosnian Muslims and Bosnian Serbs at each other's throats in shifting alignments here. And when Warren Christopher deplaned in Bosnia in December of 1995. He referred to Bosnia as a model multicultural nation. And at the time, I wrote that it was a rather interesting admission as to what multiculturalism really was, because here you had these indigestible and irreducibly antagonistic ethnic factions at each other's throats to such an extent that they could only be held together by a multinational invasion and UN occupation of what passed for their country. And I take a look at the way that the common structure, the cultural structure of our country, beginning with a common language, a common public language, and also, of course, including a shared heritage rooted in the Anglo-Saxon concept of law and a shared understanding of the primacy of our Christian culture, all these things have been very systematically undermined by people who have an interest in exacerbating the social divisions that lead to that type of potential violence as a rationale for providing us with main force as the only option to hold together what had once been a country of free people who shared these fundamental values. And, of course, the immigration policy that has existed since 1965 had the express intention of breaking down that consensus, this consensus that was based on a genuine sense of shared common heritage and destiny. And this was something that was done by way of deliberate policy. That's something that I consider to be beyond significant dispute. And it makes no sense at all to be put in a position where our tax dollars are being used to fund an assault on our common culture. And that, of course, is something that has survived every effort at immigration reform. We've really not had any serious effort to defund federally funded multiculturalism.
And, of course, nobody has suggested cutting off the funding of the Ford Foundation for La Raza and LULAC and Maldev and all the organizations of illegal immigrants, organizations set up to actually fund the illegal immigrant movement, and it's tax-exempt money from the Ford Foundation. It's about time people understood who the real enemy is and who's
exactly
coordinating this whole thing. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg to wrap up tonight's program. And you've got 3 minutes, William, to wrap up tonight's program.
Well, on that last point, with respect to the Ford Foundation being the real enemy here, there's certainly final column and the brainstem, if you will, of the whole multiculturalist movement. Georgianne Geyer, who's a member of the CFR, and so not your typical right-wing extremist or conspiracy theorist, published a book about 13 years ago called Americans No More, and I had the opportunity to interview her about some of the things she reported in that book. She talks about an encounter she had with people who were the organizers and chief representatives of Mecha and La Raza, which are a couple of the radical groups most prominently involved in this effort to foster multiculturalism and radicalize unassimilated immigrants. And she asked them about their membership and about the organizational structure. This is in the course of a private, casual conversation. And the two of them looked at each other, and there was a sort of embarrassed silence. And what they disclosed to her is, well, you know, basically we don't have membership rosters. We don't have organizational rosters. Our leadership is basically the Ford Foundation. You know, the Ford Foundation basically diversifies itself through us as appendages in order to carry out its cultural ambitions, its cultural agenda. And, of course, that's the great granddaddy of all these subversive foundations that have been involved for decades now in trying to reconfigure our nation to make it more easily digestible into this global superstate that certain people are interested in building.
And I think it's so important that people really understand that the Ford Foundation worked closely with the Council on Foreign Relations, the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation. But the Ford Foundation's job was to actually encourage this multiculturalism and, of course, to do everything they could to encourage people to come in here legally so they could change the very fabric of our society. They want an international society with many languages, with many cultures. We are all citizens of the world, aren't we? Well, I believe I happen to be an American citizen. I respect other people's rights. If people want to come here and become Americans, that's fine. We've got an awful lot of people who've come to America who don't want to be Americans, who don't want to accept our culture, who don't want to accept our language. They simply want to be here. And I don't blame them for wanting to be here. It's a better life. But in the process, they're going to destroy the very essence of America. Our guest this evening, as always, is William Grigg. Thank you so much, William, for being with us. And we'll look forward to talking to you again here very, very soon.
Thanks, Dr. Stan. God bless.
And you too. Bye-bye. Good night. And William, of course, very kind to stay up late tonight. He's going to be with us again tomorrow afternoon on our 3 o'clock program. Always a pleasure to have him. Certainly one of the most articulate spokesmen for our cause and a man who has a deep love for the United States of America, as do I. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up our program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you're out there across America listening to us, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to helping us. I would mention we've just taken on an additional 7 stations. We're going to have to pay, of course, to be on the radio, but some of them are fairly large, 50,000-watt stations. And, of course, they're only half an hour a week, but at least a half an hour a week all across America and many of the major markets, while you're people are going to have an opportunity to hear the truth. So if you can pitch in and help us, we'd appreciate hearing from you. If not, we understand many people are having financial difficulties, and I fear those financial difficulties are going to get much, much worse. But our job is, of course, to reach as many people with the truth as we can in the time God allots to us. Well, certainly we want to mention, if you have not laid in your supply of emergency food and you'd like to get an emergency food catalog, don't put off making preparations to have water with a Berkey water filter, or water storage to barrels, of course, emergency food supply, health products, excess ones on hand. You're going to need these because we don't know when the difficult times are going to come, but it's only a matter of time before they do. There are people who really want to disrupt America. Why do you think that they gave Halliburton $385 million, that actually was Kellogg Brown and Root, but a subdivision of Halliburton, $385 million in 2006, to stand by to build concentration camps? Do you think they gave them that money just because they like the way that they part their hair? Or do you think that they're planning on civilian unrest and creating civilian unrest? And believe me, they can do it. They have their agent provocateurs planted in key positions all across America to bring about chaos and a crisis situation to justify the imposition of the planned police state. And if you haven't heard my talk on the planned police state, you need to get my syllabus, and you need to get my talk on DVD. You get the two of them together at a special consideration. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, this is well known to people in the key positions. You'll actually hear Congressman Henry Gonzalez on video, a longtime head of the House Banking Commission, chairman of the House Banking Commission, talking about and saying there really is a plan in the case of a national emergency to suspend the Constitution and round up American citizens, take away the right of habeas corpus, and put them into concentration camps. You'll actually hear Congressman Gonzalez saying that, and he should know. He was a member of Congress for many years. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, there are people out there who have a different world vision. You need to hear our talk on the forbidden knowledge. You need to hear our talk or get our book on the Brotherhood of Darkness. And, of course, what most people miss is that behind the Ford Foundation are powerful spiritual forces. Henry Ford was deeply involved in spiritualism and the occult. Behind the Rockefellers, many of them are involved with the occult. Behind the Carnegie Foundation and Andrew Carnegie were, of course, occult forces. And, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations is simply a front for a secret society known as the Round Table, which was a front for the Association of Helpers, which was a front for Cecil Rhodes' secret society. And, of course, you go into the original membership of the four people. Two of them were Masons. A third was a Theosophist and involved in spiritualism. His name was William Stead. So much of this is covered in a book written by Professor Quigley called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and, of course, in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, we'll give you the references to William Stead's diary and the remarks of his daughter about how William Stead, one of the original members of the Secret Society, was deeply involved in theosophy, which, of course, is Luciferianism, and in spiritualism. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get any of our catalogs, emergency food, health, or regular catalog, we'll be glad to send them to you free of charge. If you'd like a free newsletter, you can get one if you haven't had one before. And then, of course, we ask you to go to our website at radioliberty.com. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. It is Wednesday. It is the 30th of April, 2008, and it is once again time to look at the news that the mainstream media just refuses to recognize and acknowledge and realize that the stories that we're getting from them are nothing more than subterfuge and propaganda and distraction. The news that we bring give you yet another reason to ask the question, where is your line in the sand? This is Dave Von Kleist.
And Joyce Riley. And I'll tell you, it gets more interesting every day with the waking up of the American public, with the complaints that are coming in now from the average person seeing what's taking place with their children and with their food and with their drugs. And now we move into a new arena, and I do believe it is a new arena. Let me give you an idea of what we're going to be talking about in this first half hour. And I say the first half hour because we're going to be joined at the bottom of the hour by Dr. Doug Rocky. The story that I thought I would never, ever see, and it's not a good one,